I'm not sure I can adequately express how honored I feel to be speaking with a woman by the name of Melba Patillo Beals, who is one of nine young people who were part of something incredibly important when they marched into Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. They were African American, and they were integrating Central High School. What a dramatic moment that was in our history. And all of these years later, the significance of that incredible, dramatic moment resonate very, very powerfully. Well, Melba Patillo Beals has written several different books about that experience, including I Will Not Fear, My Story of a Lifetime of Building Faith Under Fire, and Warriors Don't Cry, a searing memoir of the battle to integrate Little Rock Central High. But her most recent attempt at writing about this moment in our history and her part in it is a book intended for younger readers. It's called March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock Nine. The book is published by HMH Books for Young Readers. And Melba Patillo Beals has done great work through her life as both a journalist and communications consultant. And again, this book we're talking about today is called March Forward, Girl. Melba Patillo Beals, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It is my blessing. Please call me Melba.
I will do that, and thank you again for making time for this. I have to say, before we start talking about the book itself, that I just read that you were born on December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, the day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So
I was. So, some of us have traumatic lives. I've had quite a traumatic life.
I guess so. So you were born on a day when history changed, and of course you were part of yet another very significant day when history changed.
Right, and if you look at the pattern of my life, it's pretty much matched that. You know.
I wonder if you could say a word about the challenge of writing about your life and the difficulties of your childhood and what it was like to live in Little Rock, Arkansas, in a time when bigotry was so rampant, what it was like to write about that with young people in mind, young readers in mind. What did you think about in terms of deciding how to do that?
You have to have a goal, first of all. I think I'm a mom. I'm a twice mom. I've just finished my second generations of children. I adopted a set when I was 50. And so you have to know children, I think. I've been a teacher, both in the earliest and the latest of grades. And so I have familiarity with children and how they perceive. So I had some experience. And my goal, you have to have a goal. My goal was to not preach, but to show people, this is what it's like when you oppress. Do keep this in mind. It is such a painful experience for the target of your expression, your oppression, that you need to know what you're doing in somebody's life when you do that to them. You need to know the constancy of the misery, the anticipation that person must develop. And, you know, just look at this and see if you can get into some of these feelings, and maybe you won't do it. Yeah.
And, of course, the challenge is to write that, in this particular case, for young people to try to understand a world quite different, if not completely different, from the world in which they themselves live. I think
it's really simplistic. You have to really be simple and not leave anything out, because young people observe what we as adults take for granted.
You tell us...
For example, I talk about that the first time I really knew that we lived someplace odd, I was 3 years old. And what I noticed was not necessarily what one might think. I noticed how my parents' expression, behavior had changed when we left home and went into public. When we went to the grocery store, which was a couple blocks away, they would kowtow, curtsy, bow, let white people get in line in front of them. And, you know, little kids know it's not your turn. it's my turn to be in line, and you're going to jump in front of me for no reason? Well, I want to go home, play with my toys. I don't want to be in the grocery store, and therefore, I'm not happy about it. I think people get that point, you know.
Absolutely. I was surprised to read in the very first chapter of the book, so this is when you are still quite young, and you are already starting to notice some of these indignities suffered by you and your parents and so on. You write, "I imagined there must be places beyond Arkansas where my folks were treated better." Now, this is before there was any television in your home, because you tell us some years later when you finally got television and you saw once in a while certain famous African-Americans on television being treated very respectfully, and that was certainly a clear indication that somewhere out there black people were treated kindly and with respect. But even at a young age, you had a sense that that might be true.
Yeah, but it was based on the fact that I had two uncles, two dapper uncles that used to come down from Michigan all the time. They'd come down every couple of months. And, I had relatives that lived outside that boundary, and they'd come down there, and they would immediately get in trouble. But their visiting was significant, because they would hold me on their lap and talk to me, and they'd say to me, you know, "You should come back home with me, because at home, if you come back, you could do so many things that you can't do here."
Hmm.
So, yeah, there was a reason. And just in my, I can't tell you this, but just in my heart and in my soul, for example, the one thing I've always thought since the beginning of my life is I want to live at the edge. And I used to go back and tell my grandmother, "I'm going to live at the edge." And my grandmother said, "What do you mean by the edge?" And I said, "At the edge of the earth."
Hmm. Where things would be better.
No, in this case, I just thought that I could breathe better. Mm. I had really, really bad asthma. And I could envision a place like California where there was an ocean just beyond. And I could breathe better if there was water.
We're speaking with Melba Patillo-Beals, and her book, March Forward Girl, tells her about her experience of growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and ultimately of being one of the so-called Little Rock Nine who were brought in to integrate Central High School. You have very, very warm feelings, I'm sure, to this very day for your grandma, who you call at one point your very best friend. I could ask you about so many things you tell us about, but I want to have you describe to our listeners something that you call garden time with your grandma. Explain what garden time was all about and what a difference it made for you as a youngster.
Well, she always had a garden. And so every day at watering time and gardening time, I'd go with her. And I'd stand beside her and hold on to her dress while she was watering. Sometimes I'd get very wet. And she would talk to me about anything I wanted to talk about. It was my turn. So she would say, "Now, what is happening to you today? What's in your mind? What do you wonder about? What do you want to talk about? Do you have any questions for me?" And I always did.
Hmm.
Why are the men so big? And why do they get to be those people? And,
yeah, well, who writes these rules that makes white people feel like they're better than everybody else? I wonder if you could talk about those experiences you had in your life when you would be overtaken by what you called my Little Rock feelings. Those were the feelings of fear, of just like something in your gut, a knot in the stomach. And this would not be at home, and this wouldn't be at church, but this would be when you were out and about, for instance, at the grocery store. You hated going to the grocery store. Explain what going to the grocery store was like and what made it so hurtful for you.
Well, little kids want to do what? They want to touch everything. So the rule in the grocery store was black people couldn't touch anything, because they said if we touched it, nobody would want to buy it. Right? Mm. We'd make it all tainted and stinky. Well, what do you mean, stinky? I take baths every night.
If a black person touched anything on the shelves, then a white person coming along behind them wouldn't want to purchase
right.
that. So you were forbidden from touching anything at all.
What are we going to do about this? But it was just so hard to think that when I got into public, I had to stand a certain way, stand in a certain place, usually wait for somebody to come along. But if that didn't happen, we would plan on burning a whole day.
Explain the so-called rules of survival, which you were told about by your grandmother and your mother and father, for that matter. What were those rules of survival, and what were the ones that were hardest for you to follow as a youngster?
Well, okay, so don't look a white person in the face. We know that Emmett Till got killed for that one. If somebody's coming down a sidewalk and you're walking up the sidewalk, you step off into the mud. No matter the gender or age or anything, this person, it's you do it. If someone is studying a library, you open it up and sell it.
You tell us that church was one place where you felt, at least for the most part, very, very safe. That was a place of community, of fellowship, and a place where the fears that you felt in a place like the grocery store or the department store were just not a part of the proceedings. You experienced...
No, you step inside of there, and the most important thing you felt at church in the beginning was safety. Nobody's going to hit me. Nobody's going to call me a nigger. It's going to be so great. My parents are going to smile. They're going to get that you or Frank smile off their face. And they're going to get the real smile. And it's going to be so nice there. You know.
There is something truly terrifying and horrifying that you witness. I believe not in your own church. I believe it was in another church where you actually witnessed someone from the Ku Klux Klan invading that space, that holy space, in a way that had to be truly sickening for you, especially when one thinks about if church for you was a place of sanctuary in the truest sense of the word. Nothing could have been more terrible than to have that sense of sanctuary shattered. Did church...
Well, isn't God somebody? To each and every one of us, somebody who we are, God is somebody. And God was the church, according to Grandma, and everybody in my family. And so, therefore, if there was, absolutely one inch of anything, the happiness of it all would be shown to you at church. That's how I felt. But eventually, I had to understand that that wasn't, if it had been used, abused.
You tell us about those moments when you would have glimmers of hope, such as when your grandma told you about a baseball player by the name of Jackie Robinson, and you remember listening to him on the radio and feeling some sense of hope. Something else that gave you a tremendous sense of hope was when you and your family visited St. Louis, Missouri. Say a quick word about why that trip was such a dramatic one for you, and why it was hard to return to Little Rock.
Yeah, by this time I was a young teenager, and I got to experience what I had envisioned. That was the city where... But white folks didn't just call you a nigger on the street. You could walk into a store and touch the merchandise. I mean, it was so fabulous. There were, just what was out, the groceries and stuff. You could touch anything you wanted. I mean, it was beyond my comprehension.
And, of course, you write about how it made it even worse when you got back on that train, a segregated train, and returned to Little Rock and returned to that life where life meant so many indignities on a daily basis.
Unbelievable. And in the church, I witnessed a man be hanged. So now you've taken away the only sanctuary I have in my life. If you're riding a bus, you're vulnerable. No matter where you were, you were vulnerable now. And church wasn't an exception. And that really worried me.
Right. Your book is a book that tells us a lot about what life was like for your family and families like your family in a place like Little Rock, Arkansas. But it also, along with an unsparing portrayal of what the frustrations were of life, there are also these moments when there was hope, when once in a while you would experience kindness from a white person, or when you would receive a certain gift that might be important to you, like a gift that was given to you on your birthday in 1950, a gift from your grandma of a globe. Why do you think that globe was so extraordinarily important to you at that point?
Well, there before me was the world. There before me was a place where the Klan did not ride every afternoon at dusk. There before me were all the places I dreamed about. California that I'd seen in the 17 magazine. Things I'd seen mentioned, you know. To me, one of the most precious things in my life was magazines. Because they gave me pictures, once we could get a hold of when I was a little older, they gave me pictures of what was beyond my border. I was a happy girl. Somebody came over with an old magazine. Oh, it was precious. I preserved it for years.
Wow. You eventually come to have a more sophisticated understanding of what these Jim Crow laws were all about.
I was steaming when someone taught me as I got older that there's actually written on paper a set of laws that pertain to this. This is not just accidental. You know?
Well, and it also was a moment when you realized that these white people, they themselves were not, in a sense, breaking the law or in their eyes doing anything wrong when they were doing these things to you. They were following the law, a terrible evil law that was in place. And of course that had to change everything about the way that you felt. And
to learn that there was something that granted white people permission to treat me like doggy do was startling. Because then I know that I'm doomed. Who's going to go in there and collect those people? They can treat me any way they want if they're alone. Nobody witnesses.
And then in 1954, there is the beginning of a dramatic change with the Supreme Court ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education saying that, in fact, separate was not equal, and ordering the integration of schools, a move which was met with immense anger and resistance by most of the white community of Little Rock, including the school board.
On that day, that very day, I literally almost got raped by a man who said, give you niggas an inch, you take a mile. Now you think you're going to school with my babies. You're not doing that.
Tell our listeners about how you, in effect, accidentally volunteered to perhaps be considered to be one of the first black students to help integrate Central High. Explain what your teacher asked in the schoolroom that morning.
She walked through the classroom and said, will those who live in the district of Central High School raise your hand? And I did, and then she said, okay. Will those who want to go to Central High School raise their hand? Well, I did. Not everybody did. I did. And then she said, well, I have this sheet of paper you can sign. You need to give it to your parents for a signature. In compliance with the 1954 Brown decision, there will begin integration in these schools next September.
And ultimately, you were one of the nine who were selected to walk through that door of Central High School. What were the things that they were looking for in terms of carefully choosing those first nine students who would integrate Central High School? What were they looking for?
They sifted the school, and they began that sift by saying those who were did not have behavior problems, those who had good grades, those who had attitude of respect for older people, and those who were clean in their dress and their presentation. Those were the basics.
Hmm. As you approach Central High School that first day, accompanied by Little Rock. No, I think the first day, were you accompanied by anybody at all aside from your mother?
You know, the head of the local NAACP, they sort of dropped us off. In my case, I was accompanied by my mom because we were late and got separated from the others. And there was really no formal plan. I mean, the problem with that first day was we lacked a systemic plan because who the heck thought we'd be in that much trouble?
Mm.
So, but the, you know, the woman who was head of the NAACP said, "Well, you know, we'll meet on a certain corner," and we did. We were supposed to, you know. Now imagine that the expanse of this school is from 14th to 16th Street. It's eight blocks in diameter. Two across, two down, two across the back, and two up the side. So it's a big place. It's not a small place. And so we were supposed to meet on the corner of, like, I think, 14th Street. And so there we were, my mother and I. We get there, this huge crowd. It's like going to the rodeo. You know, we thought, well, what's happening? Maybe Johnny Mathis or somebody really special has come to see the opening day of school.
If only.
If only.
Yes.
And we thought, well, it sounds like a football game. You know how when you come into a football game, all the yelling and screaming. And at first you can't distinguish the words.
Right.
You just hear the yelling.
Right.
And it takes a moment for the yelling to turn into words. And there's excitement because, first of all the people are white. So it takes your mind. See, you don't really quickly discern the amount of trouble you're totally in. It takes a while for it to, wait a minute, these are white people. No black people are in here yelling and screaming like this. Why are they yelling and screaming, and what are they looking across the street at? Well, they were looking at one of our number, Elizabeth Eckford, walk a gauntlet in front of the school.
Right.
They were looking at her being escorted by a ugly group of white people who would call her every name in the book and tell her she wasn't worth it.
Well, ultimately, this mob, of course, turns you away. You return the next day with police, and eventually you have to be escorted into school with soldiers. I mean, one can hardly imagine what that was like. Have you ever stopped to think about how much your experience was a little bit like that of Jackie Robinson and what he faced when he first entered Major League Baseball?
Absolutely. But in some ways, we were children. And so somehow in my mind, I thought adults don't hurt children. You know, I'm 15 years of age. So you don't envision, at 14 and 15, I didn't envision death. I didn't envision adults would misbehave that way. I didn't envision, you know, I had to trust God from the beginning. They've been holding meetings in the white community and the black community. And in my community, my grandmother always talked to us about how we're going to get through this is we're going to trust God.
Hmm.
You know, you're not getting through this because you smell great. You get through it because in your soul there must be a belief that you're doing the right thing.
As I was reading your book, I was realizing that the news cameras only captured that ugly scene outside of Central High School as the Arkansas 9, Little Rock 9 walked up to that front door with that mob of protesters there hurling insults and so on. But cameras never showed, as far as I know at least, anything once you entered the building and what daily life was like.
At one point, one of the New York Times reporters and the Life reporters infiltrated. They were tiny people, ladies, and they came in and acted as students.
Wow. So,
but no, there was no shooting on the inside.
Right. So you're one of the only people, you and your counterparts, are the only ones, in a sense, who can really say much about what day-to-day life was like. How did the experience in Central High School as a student in this otherwise all-white school compare to other incidents that you had experienced earlier in your life, experiences that brought you fear and discomfort? Was this about the same, much, much worse, not quite as bad?
No. It was the most astounding, overwhelming experience in my life, still today, and I'm 76. The change from being a fairly calm, fairly settled, safe teenager in your home, as safe as you can be, to being in this environment, it was like going to war. It was like, no, wait a minute. These people really won't kill me to keep from going to school. Then, oh, yeah, they will. They killed somebody last night. They're not practicing rope making for nothing. They'll get you, kiddo. And then what will you do?
Wow. What kind of response did you have from the teachers there versus the white students? By and large, did the teachers seem willing to teach you, albeit perhaps grudgingly?
Some of them grudgingly, some of them quite willing and helpful. If they got too friendly, they got castigated.
By some of their colleagues.
One boy screamed out loud to my English teacher at one point, you're a nigger lover, you're a nigger lover, you wait.
Wow. What kind of difference did any of the white students make in terms of the, granted, I'm sure, relatively few who were not quite so openly hostile? I mean, were there kindnesses shown to you? And through the course of the year, did that situation in any significant way improve?
Well, I would say not a lot. It improved probably 15-20%, but not because people were more willing to allow us in, but because the army, the local army's routine was much like that of the norm, and they were into a lot of other things. For example, they were just into the transition part of it, you know. And so near the end of the school, soldiers were left, and we were there by ourselves. And on the last few days of school, the vice principal, Mrs. Huckabee, offered to keep all of us like there.
Mm. At some point, you made mention of a bodyguard. Did you always have a bodyguard with you in school?
Always, but not till the end, as long as the soldiers were in town.
So it was either soldiers on duty or a bodyguard assigned to you to try
No, there was no bodyguard assigned. It was while the soldiers were in town, the bodyguard were the soldiers.
I see. So when the soldiers left, there was no bodyguard.
Goodbye.
Wow. What kind of learning were you able to do through the course of that year? That is,
well, you know, not much, but I kept my grades up. Not as good as they had been. I kept them up, however, because in my household, there's no coming home with low grades.
Right. But I was just thinking how mentally and emotionally it was such a difficult experience, such a difficult scenario in which to be able to concentrate and focus. I'm sure it had to be a really, really difficult challenge in that respect.
Well, it was one that you couldn't always discern. Like, what's going to happen to me today? How's that going down? And how can I respond in a way that will save my life? Mm. And you get more bold as the time proceeds. I got more bold, you know.
Really?
For example, at the dark end of the school, these boys trapped me. And this one boy is standing up against me, pushing me against the cabinets. And I figure out he's going to kill me. The only way I'm getting out is reaching for his testicles, and I did. You got to protect yourself. You know, in the end, also, my soldier taught me about self-protection. He said, you got to do what you got to do till you can get to safety, you know.
Hmm. How difficult was it to resist the urge to fight back in a way that might have led to your being expelled, as happened to one of the nine? I mean, was it difficult for you to, in a sense, toe the line and tolerate this kind of treatment, or were you bound and determined to do so one way or another?
I pretty much tried. We all had to follow the prescribed treatment, because what good would it have done to spend all that time tortured and mistreated and then blow it? So we really did, and it was interesting. Dr. Martin Luther King came down to visit us a couple of times, and he was really clear on saying, you set your goals in life, and that's what you work for.
Mm. You did make it through the year, but of course, in that following summer, there was a very, very frightening development with the local Ku Klux Klan that you tell us about in your book. Explain the kind of dire danger that you and the other nine suddenly found yourself in.
The whole situation of going to school with no guards was incredible. And at one point, the vice principal hit us in her office. Is that what you mean? The transitioning out was difficult.
Right.
Because by the end of the year, they were determined we were not going to go back. And the governor was absolutely determined we were not going to go back. So it was a very ugly scene. And we felt as though we had very little shield between us and those hooligans who would do bad.
Right. And who wanted to see you apprehended, perhaps even killed. Your parents...
Well, yeah, they threatened to have us beaten. And, you know, they knew the jail terms. They said, we can get up, you can't. Meant, you know, girls. It was an ugly, ugly road, pedal to the metal scene where
right.
You had to pray, you had to go rare, prayed up, and when something awful happened, you had to turn inward for your support.
Right.
There was no adult within the limits of that school that was going to help you, not really.
Hmm. Ultimately, your parents made what I'm sure was a difficult decision and yet a necessary decision. To have you go off to actually Santa Rosa, California to complete your high school.
Yes, because I write that I had a relative who was in the Klan, like all black families. We were a mixed black family. And he was passing the numbers, and so he called up to say, Mother Lois, how great that was. And we said, look, what's up? And he said, you're going to be killed. We said, you know, it's up to you to attend a Klan meeting and find out what they got in store for us.
Wow. So your parents sent you off to Santa Rosa, California, and you finished your high school education there. And actually, you write in your book about actually the extraordinary experience you had about living with this family called the McCabes. Just say a word about how transformative this time was in Santa Rosa, California, and what kind of difference it made for the life that you've lived since.
Well, I landed there in great fear. See, I didn't know till I got to the airport, or I didn't know till I got to the San Francisco airport that I was going to go live with a white family. I was a black family. Nobody said that to me. And my mother really didn't know that it was a white family. And so I was just stiff with fear. But they said, come on, go home, go over. And I got into the van, and we went home, and it was a very difficult time to see life implode on the gentleman who guaranteed to get us out.
Well, you end up experiencing life as you had never experienced it before in a place where, at least for the most part, you were not the target of bigotry and discrimination as you had been.
Well, the goal was, of course, to end up in Santa Rosa. But, for example, even in Santa Rosa, there was some racism. Papa took me to swim in the pool, and they wouldn't let me swim in the pool, so Daddy made these placards and marched up and down. There was no racism in the school, however. I never once in Montgomery High School felt anything but, you know, curiosity. That love is the answer, and that not all white people were involved in this. Some of them did step up to the plate. The ministers, the Christians, stepped up to save our lives. I wouldn't be here if they didn't.
Well, it's a remarkable story, and I'm so glad you tell it as well as you do in this book, March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock Nine, published by HMH Book It's for young readers. I'm sure many young people will read this and be fascinated and inspired by your story, as I was. Melba Patilla Beals, thank you so much, and very best wishes, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. I was honored to speak with you.
My honor, my pleasure, my blessing. God bless.
At 8:45, you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two coming up in a moment. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about a topic which is so incredibly important, and the few minutes available to us for this topic today are not nearly enough to really even scratch the surface of something that needs to be discussed much more fully and deeply and openly. And it is about the situation which afflicts so many young African-American males in our country. We do not seem to even yet fully understand, fully grasp the kind of pressures, the kind of traumas which they are dealing with. And in many cases, we end up only dealing with maybe surface offenses or the most simplistic of assumptions, and fail to really probe into what is going on in the minds and hearts of young African-American males, children, adolescents, young adults. A sprawling and impressive new book has just been published called The Psychology of Black Boys and Adolescents. It is a collection of a number of important writings by important experts in the field and edited by two gentlemen who I will be speaking with. First with Dr. Kirtland C. Vaughns. In a few minutes, I'll speak with his colleague, Dr. Warren Spielberg. Dr. Kirtland Vaughns is a licensed clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst, founding editor of the Journal of Infant, Child, and Adolescent Psychotherapy, associate professor of psychology at the Deamer Institute of Advanced Psychiatry Studies at Adelphi University. And he is one of the two editors of this really important book, and also one of the two people involved in a long-term study of young African-American males, trying to get at the heart of what life is like for them and what we can do to help more young African-Americans lead successful and happy lives. Kirtland Vaughns, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you very much. I want to learn from you more about this thing called the Brotherman Study, which was begun back in 2001. Tell us what galvanized you to begin this study and what it has entailed over these years.
At the time, I wanted very much to conduct this study and knew that I could not do it alone. So I approached Warren Spielberg and asked if he would join forces with me, and he gladly did. Thank God. And what we did was we interviewed 60 young black males, boys, and adolescents. And initially we started interviewing them individually, and we wrote a book as an outcome of that, but the book was rejected by the publisher on the grounds that nobody would have any real interest in black boys. And so what we then did was to decide to edit these two volumes instead. What we found was very interesting. You used the word trauma. And during the course of our interviews with these boys, we would ask them to describe their daily experiences in school, their experiences in the community, and their experiences with the police. They would describe instances where it was explicitly a racist attitude or behavior towards them, having them sit in the back of the class, having their work dismissed as not theirs, And when we would ask them what they made of this, what their thoughts were, what they thought was going on with the teacher, they would typically respond that the teacher must have had a difficult day. They seemed to be more impacted with the teacher than they were with themselves. And so when we would talk about their internal world, they could not make a connection with that whatsoever. We then put them into groups to see if they could help each other. They could not. We then brought in girls, black girls, and the girls were able to get in touch with their feelings and help the boys to begin to express it. So we came to call this trying not to know, because these experiences were too painful for them. They recognized that they were being rejected in the world and being rejected very early on. They were being penalized through heavy suspensions, through expulsions, through referrals to special education. And so the climate in the school, they had a sense of themselves as being penalized for being black. Another issue we examined that really goes against them was most often they're not seen as boys. This developmental stage, which is crucial to the development of their humanity, is denied them. Typically, they are seen as 4 to 5 years their senior.
Hmm.
Of course, this is not occurring with white boys at all.
In many situations, in the media and other authority figures, in many, many cases, we might look at a 7-year-old, and if they're white, we'll refer to them as a boy. But if we see an African-American 7-year-old, quite often we will not use the word boy. We'll use the word male or some other term. But the fact that we withhold the term boy is one way in which we are also, in a sense, withholding affection and protection from that youngster.
Absolutely. Yes. You're absolutely on point. I think it was in Ferguson where the officer shot the 12-year-old boy in the stomach as he pulled up on him, and he reported in his report, he said, 20-year-old African male down. Am I still with you?
Yes, yes. I think one of the most intriguing things about this study that you did, in which you interviewed all of these African-American boys and adolescents trying to get at the heart of what they were thinking and feeling, was that you and Warren Spielberg were doing so as a team that are, in effect, black and white. You happen to be African-American. He is white. What kind of effect do you think that ultimately had on this study and on the interaction that you had with these young males, many of whom found it, as you already have said, tremendously difficult to offer up, in a sense, deep or revealing insights about what they were experiencing and feeling?
One of the things we found was that was true across the board for Warren and myself until they really felt that we were involved with them, that we cared about them. And then they began to be able to take the risk and examine their internal world. I think what is important about the racial difference between Warren and myself, Warren, as you say, who is white and I'm black, is that, one, it's not a black issue. It is a national issue, and it will take both white and black to resolve it. In addition, I think it says how whites can be, as Warren is white. He was very helpful to the boys. And when Warren would speak by himself, and I'm not present, their mothers were so grateful to him that he was involved with black boys and that he was trying to help them resolve these very, very crucial issues. Because we talk about school as as an impediment to their development. We talk about school as part of the train to to prison, pipeline to prison, and the fact that jobs, the jobs that are offered within the community are not jobs that help them with their professional or career development.
Hmm. Tell us, in the final question, how personal experience this was for you in terms of it bringing you, in a sense, back in touch with your own childhood and anything which you yourself might have faced as a young black boy and adolescent and young adult. In what way was this, in a sense, a revelatory experience for you yourself?
I am the father of a young black man who's now 22, so it revived both experiences, traumatic experiences for me, trying to protect my son. In the schools that he attended, I had placed him in private schools as a way of trying to protect him. But even there, I had to go and attend to make sure that he was okay, being accused of things that he had not done. And it reminded me, it brought back to memory a number of things that had occurred to me that I had never spoken of. And that was in my senior year in high school. I wrote a paper. I had been a library page, so I had read the books in the library on juvenile delinquency, and I wrote a paper on it, handed it in, and my English teacher told me, "You did not write this. Who wrote this?" And I kept saying, I wrote the paper. He gave me an F, which meant I failed that semester, had to attend summer school. So I've experienced a lot of what they were describing, and that it's still going on today. So it wasn't that new.
Kirkland Vaughns is one of the two editors of this new book called The Psychology of Black Boys and Adolescents, published by Prager. Kirkland Vaughns, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. Thank you for your good work on this important topic.
And thank you for having us.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Racine Mayor Corey Mason will be joining us, along with Nan Calvert, to address a number of different issues, including issues related to the environment here in southeastern Wisconsin. We'll be honored to have the mayor with us tomorrow. On Friday, Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, director of the Carthage Choir, and several of the members of the Carthage Choir, who are just back from a tour of Europe, which took in among other things, such beautiful cities as Budapest, Venice, and Rome. They have a homecoming concert that they will be singing this Sunday, the 11th. Early next week, on Monday, three librarians from the Big Read, librarians from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, talking about this year's Big Read project. And by the way, we'll be speaking with the author of this year's book, Station 11, on Wednesday's morning show. That's Emily St. John Mandel. On Tuesday's morning show, we'll preview for you a PBS documentary called The Bombing of Wall Street, and we'll be talking with a member of Ochis 8, which is going to be performing at Carthage College on Thursday evening. We remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You find the program archived on our website, which is WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.